there's enough evidence to be concerned. Let's think about changes to the policy so that we can get around this and really start addressing it. And that's the strategy that I would recommend to CMS.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Ashish Jha, the head of Harvard's Global Health Institute and a critic of Medicare's readmissions policy. That policy originally had lots of support. Use the Affordable Care Act to create incentives for hospitals to deliver the best quality care so patients don't have to come back. The challenge has been implementing those incentives without unintended consequences. And there's more and more evidence that hospitals may be gaming the system, turning away patients who end up suffering as a result. Ashish has been a prominent critic of the policy for a long time. We discuss how it got developed and what the latest data says. And near the end of the episode, we also talk about the broader global health landscape under the Trump administration and Ashish's own career. Just a reminder, if you like Pulse Check, you can help us by rating or reviewing the show on your favorite podcast app. Now, there's another podcast called Pulse Check. It has nothing to do with healthcare. Make sure you're searching for Politico's Pulse Check and rating us there. And now, here's my conversation with Ashish. Dr. Ashish Jha, welcome back to Politico Pulse Check.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dan. It's always fun to be here.
Last week's guest, Sarah Cliff, she hobbled into the studio on crutches. You just took a flight from Europe in time for this podcast. Next week, our guest will have to like travel through time or something. Why were you in Europe? What was the occasion?
So I was in Geneva in some meetings. You know, I do a lot of work on global health and thinking about health systems around the globe. And a lot of those meetings happen in Geneva because of the World Health Organization and other entities that are there. So I was only there for a couple of days.
There are a lot of public health problems occupying the minds of global health leaders. There's Ebola in the Congo. There's climate change. There are concerns about drug pricing. The list goes on. Where does hospital readmissions, this issue where millions of patients have to go back to the hospital shortly after being discharged, where does that rank as a public health priority for you?
So I think hospital readmissions are a really important problem. And, you know, it's an area where, I mean, again, it's hard to know how to compare it to Ebola or climate change. Those are, of course, very big issues. But for our healthcare system, for Americans, and I would actually say for people in lots of other countries as well, thinking about how to make sure that hospital care is high quality, it's efficient, is enormously important. And readmissions are an important part of that discussion.
We should do some framing for the audience. One reason I wanted to talk to you, Ashish, is because readmissions have been in the news. Under the Affordable Care Act, there was a program, the Hospital Readmissions Reduction Program, that was launched about 6 years ago. Results from that program are coming in, and the goal was to encourage hospitals to provide better care and make sure that when patients were discharged, they didn't have to come back within a handful of days or weeks. There is now concern, looking at some recent studies, that hospitals are either gaming the system or that the patients who are most at risk are suffering from this program. What is the top line to you on what we have learned about readmissions over the past number of years?
Yeah, so if we take a step back and ask, like, why did we even create this program? I mean, it seemed so obvious on the face of it that people were bouncing back within a week, within a month. And we said, boy, like, you know, if you had to take your car back to the mechanic within a few days with any frequency, you'd say that's a problem and we gotta fix that. It turns out people are not cars and hospitals are not like mechanics. People are sick and complicated. And the top line is that there have been a host of problems with this readmissions penalty program, and almost all of them were predictable. Safety net hospitals have really gotten crushed under this program. They've gotten most of the penalties. And now we're starting to see data that mortality rates might have actually gone up because hospitals were trying to avoid readmitting people who probably needed the hospital. You know, the hospital is a great place if you're really sick and need it. And I think this program may have actually done more harm than good in terms of the patients that it's supposed to serve.
You say that these problems were predictable. And I do remember at a conference a couple of years ago, you were raising concerns then that the incentives were pointed the wrong direction. Was there something that you saw in the early data, or was it just in the way that the plan was constructed that was so concerning to you back then?
Yeah, so there were a few things that were pretty obvious from the beginning, right? One was that a critical part of all of these things is you got to get risk adjustment right. You got to make sure that if you're a hospital that takes care of really sick people, you're not getting penalized more than if you're a hospital that has relatively healthy people. Yet we knew that the models for readmissions just didn't get risk adjustment down very well. The second thing is that they completely ignored social factors. Look, if you've got a homeless population that you're caring for, you know those people are going to have a much harder time getting good care after they're discharged. And you don't want to penalize hospitals for taking care of poor people. And yet we knew that that's what the penalty program was going to do. So there was a bunch of stuff that was predictable just based on how it was constructed. And then the last but not least was something that a lot of us brought up, is if you were a hospital that had a high mortality rate and a low readmission rate, you got bonuses compared to hospitals that had low mortality but high readmissions. That made no sense. I mean, it just makes no sense to say readmissions matter more than death. And so in some ways, the whole construct of the program, I think, led most of us who were independent observers looking at this to say this is not going to turn out as well as we hope.
And just to pull that point out, what you're saying, Doctor, is that you think the mission of this program was conflicting with the mission of what it means to be a hospital.
Well, I mean, look, I think the program was created with good intentions. I mean, there was that idea that, boy, it'd be great to get hospitals to focus on preventing rehospitalization. In isolation, I think it was done with all the right intentions. The problem is in the broader context, I think, and again, many of us pointed this out, you know, 6-8 years ago, it was very clear that there were issues of competing risk. There were issues of, you know, do I readmit the person or do I send them home and maybe they're going to have an increased risk of death? That we needed to have thought through all of that. I think most people who were clinicians saw this coming. I think policymakers just ignored the critique that was coming from the clinical audience because they just saw it as, you know, doctors being whiny about this and didn't, I think through all of the implications.
I think another challenge a couple of years ago was that this was a program rolled out by the Obama administration, and there was President Obama pointing to this as an example of success under the Affordable Care Act. There was a measurable decline in the number of patients who were readmitted. Roughly 1 in 5 Medicare patients were readmitted within 30 days when this program was launched. That has, depending on your perspective, that rate has fallen. Things have improved by a fraction of some percentage points. So pouring cold water on an Obama policy at the time that the Obama administration was in office may be less easy to do in Washington now that the Trump administration is here and taking a new look at the program. We should also say, Doctor, while there is data suggesting that mortality has gone the wrong way and that hospitals may be using coding tricks to make it seem like they're doing better on these measures, there are studies that have said mortality hasn't been affected and Medicare is saving billions of dollars. So defenders of this program can point to evidence that they say justifies this initiative.
Yeah. Right. So, and I'm happy to go through what the evidence is, but here is, I think, a really critical issue, which is, as your listeners know, the Affordable Care Act was passed under very difficult circumstances, almost didn't get through. And like any piece of complex legislation, they didn't get everything right. I mean, no one ever does. And so the readmissions program, again, even though some of us were concerned about it from the early days, as the data rolled in, for instance, we saw very early on that safety net hospitals were getting the bulk of the penalties. And so a bunch of us raised this issue and said, hey, let's fix this. Let's just fix that part of the readmissions program. And there was incredible resistance from the Obama administration, I think because of the polarized nature of Washington and health policy during the Obama years. You know, for the Republicans, any effort to criticize or beat up on the ACA was, you know, was seen as a political win. And that, of course, led the Democrats and the Obama administration to defend every aspect of the ACA, even when I think a lot of them knew that there were important things that weren't working well. So I think that polarized nature of the debate really made it very difficult to address these issues. And that was unfortunate because, you know, a lot of us believe in the principles behind the ACA, right? Like expanding coverage to more Americans. Check. Great thing to do. Pushing the health payment system towards value-based payment models. Great. Like, we want to do that. I think all of these were well-intentioned, good ideas. There just wasn't the space needed to be able to criticize it in a way that didn't seem like you were criticizing the ACA or criticizing the Obama administration. You just were trying to make the bill and the policies work better.
I've heard that CMS under the Trump administration may be looking at changing the policy. This is a statement that I got from CMS today. Quote, any finding in the medical literature suggesting that CMS programs may be associated with increased mortality is of deep concern. And the statement goes on to say that the agency is thoroughly reviewing the current research and may use that to inform future actions. I'm curious, Dr. Jha, has the Trump administration reached out to you, someone who's been a critic of this readmissions policy? Have you talked to them? Are you planning to meet with them?
So I've spoken to senior officials in the Trump administration in this at CMS about a wide range of policies, including the readmissions program. I haven't actually had a conversation with them since the latest studies came out. So I don't know exactly what they're thinking. But, you know, I have spoken to them kind of in general about strategies to try to improve value through CMS programs.
Secretary Alex Azar, the health secretary, famously became a hospital readmission himself last year. He had been admitted. Yeah, we talked. I wrote about it. You were quoted in my write up. He had been admitted to the hospital with an intestinal issue. He was quickly discharged, then promptly readmitted. I have not had a chance to ask him about this. I know he tells people that he talks to that it changed his thinking on whether the condition even required being in the hospital in the first place. But I'd love to know if, as someone who is nominally working to cut readmissions and then became a readmission, if that opened a window for him to think differently about the policy. Here's something that I'm wrestling with, Doctor. So there have been studies, and we'll include links to this in the show notes, in JAMA, written by a number of well-regarded researchers. Health Affairs did a paper from your colleagues at Harvard that came out recently as well. There is mounting evidence that would support the readmissions policy was either too quickly rolled out or poorly designed. Is there still not enough data, given that there are other studies that have been cited by groups like the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission that suggest things are okay? Are we still too early to make a definitive determination on how serious these challenges are?
Yeah, it's a great question, Dan. And look, first of all, we're a good 7-8 years into the launch of this program. And it was announced in 2010. It was implemented at the end of 2011. And here we are in 2019. So the question is, how much longer do you want to wait? In all of this stuff, I think there are a few things that are, in my mind, very clear, I mean, where the evidence is not really controversial. One is that probably about 2/3 of the drop in admissions, readmissions that we see is due to coding changes. Basically, about the same time that the policy was announced, CMS made a bunch of other changes around how hospitals coded for sickness, and it looked overnight like the whole world just got a whole lot sicker. Of course, the hospital population in America did not get sicker overnight. What happened was that hospitals just started coding for a lot more illnesses. That meant that anything that uses risk adjustment, it's going to look like you're taking care of sicker patients, and you're going to see drops in readmissions or mortality from that. So probably about 2/3. That's, I think, the best evidence. On mortality, there have been a couple of different studies, right? And as you alluded to, they show a little bit of contradictory findings. The analyses that have been done by the Yale group that created the measure seems to not find much of a negative impact. Independent researchers who are not affiliated with the group that actually created the measure tend to find, I think, more worrisome findings. Here's my question. Okay, so we don't know for sure. How long do we want to wait, and what's the cost of waiting? I mean, if the answer is that independent research suggests that mortality rates may be going up, that to me is pretty concerning. And I would not say, hey, let's give it five more years and get really, really sure that people are dying before we make changes to the policy. That does not seem to me to be prudent. A much more prudent approach is to say there's enough evidence to be concerned. Let's think about changes to the policy so that we can get around this and really start addressing it. And that's the strategy that I would recommend to CMS if they were to call me, is to say, I don't think we have the luxury of waiting until all the data are in.
How much of a risk of bias is there in that the Yale researchers who were paid to consult on the policy and help develop it are now some of the most vocal advocates defending it?
So look, I mean, this is an ongoing concern in all of healthcare where you have issues of conflict of interest that come up, I think, over and over again. In my mind, Harlan Krumholtz, the kind of leader of the Yale group, who's been the senior author and the advocate, I think he is principled. I think he's trying to do the right thing. I think he's a good, fundamentally good person. I don't have any questions about his ethics or him as a scientist. I think he's a very good scientist. I think the challenge is all of us have our innate biases, whether they be financial or intellectual. And what I think is really important is we look across the broad set of data out there, the broad set of work that's been done, and not be overly swayed by any one group or another. And it's when I look at the entire landscape that I start seeing really concerning signs and signals. I don't discount the work that Harlan does because he's got a financial conflict. I just look at it in the broader context of everything else that's out there.
It's always risky in terms of bias asking a Harvard leader what he thinks of a Yale researcher. I will tell listeners that if they're curious for more of Dr. Krumholtz's perspective, I'll make sure that there's a link or two in the show notes. There was a story by Paul Espan in the New York Times recently that quoted Dr. Krumholtz, and he has been prolific in defending the policy as well. In the time that we have left, I wanted to shift to some of your other work. You're just back from the trip to Geneva. You're Harvard's global health leader. You direct the institute. What does the world think of the United States health strategy now, 2 years into the Trump administration?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think it's very confusing in some ways. So look, it's worth remembering that the U.S., the government, but also through nonprofit organizations like the Gates Foundation. But even if you just take the U.S. government, the dominant funder of global health in the world. It's the biggest funder of WHO. It's the biggest funder of research into diseases that are, we think of as sort of traditionally neglected. So the U.S. remains a very important force for global health and a very important force for good in global health. And yet, what you get out of the administration, certainly out of the president, is this constant talk of America first, America first. And of course, in my mind, misunderstanding what it means to be an America first person. It's good for America when the world is healthier, when the world is safer, when there are not disease outbreaks happening around the world. So it's a very narrow understanding of America first that the president seems to espouse. So I think he has created a lot of confusion because the policies have not changed dramatically. I mean, there are some specific areas, certainly around family planning, where there have been dramatic changes in policy, but we saw that with previous Republican administrations as well. But there has not been this big pullback that I think a lot of us were worried about. That said, the world continues to be a dangerous place when it comes to global health issues. So we do have this outbreak of Ebola in the DRC, and this is a place where America needs to take much greater leadership than it has. And we're not seeing that kind of forward thinking leadership from this administration. In many ways, what they've done is just continued what was happening before in terms of funding and support. I think a different administration, I even think a Bush administration, a George W. Bush administration, would have taken a more activist role in tackling these things because, when America leads, it makes America stronger and the world safer.
You mentioned the Ebola outbreak, the second worst on record, centered in the DRC and in Africa. My reporting suggests that this administration, and specifically inside HHS, has really been wrestling with how much to lean in versus lean out. And the CDC has not always been on the same page as HHS proper here in D.C. The CDC has been more ambitious with what it has wanted to do. HHS under the Trump administration, less concerned with intervening in the Ebola outbreak.
Yeah, this just shows the tension within the U.S. government. Because again, at CDC, these are career public health leaders, public health officials. They know, I think, what the right thing to do here is. And it's not just the right thing for the people of the DRC, though of course it is that. But it's just the right thing to do for the world, including for people in the United States, which is America should be very forward-leaning. We should have people on the ground helping WHO, helping other organizations combat and really get our arms around this outbreak. Because one of the things that we learned from the last Ebola outbreak in West Africa is that when the disease spreads, it becomes much harder to manage. And while it remains in the DRC, both for the sake of the people there, but really for all of us, it's super important that we be very forward-leaning. Again, I understand that that creates a conflict with the stated policy of our president, who thinks that, you know, we can put walls up and keep viruses and diseases out. Not possible in the year 2019. And so in the world that we live in, that tension makes a lot of sense.
You mentioned the change in family planning policies. Obviously, here in the States, we're seeing that happen with changes to the Title X funding program, for instance. But that has also manifested in how the United States has changed documents, shifted its policy internationally. And I've written on this, Ashish, the idea that there has already been and will continue to be taking out of language in global health documents of what either diplomats can say about sex education, about sexual terms. There's a staffer at HHS, a political appointee named Valerie Huber, who is an advocate for abstinence, or as she puts it, she says abstinence isn't quite the right term, sexual risk avoidance, who has recently moved over to the global health office at HHS. And her charter, in part, will be to go through the documents, the global health documents that this administration puts out, and strip references to sexual terms, sex education. I know that this has happened to some extent before under previous presidents. As you said, Republicans have pushed this agenda. But how much should we worry about changes to documents that are driven around reproductive health ideology and perhaps not by the science?
Yeah. So look, improving reproductive health, access to reproductive health for women around the world is probably one of the very best things that we can do to improve people's lives and well-being. We know that. There's very good evidence behind that. And it's one thing, I think, look, whether there are clearly people in the within the administration who, for instance, are opposed to abortion. And so if they say, okay, the U.S. government is not going to fund programs that support abortion, I understand that. There's a and again, reasonable people can disagree on that, but one understands that. When you get into wholesale changes behind the science of how you promote reproductive health, that gets far more problematic because fundamentally, you want to let science guide the policy here. And I worry a lot about political appointees. And a bit of this happens in every administration. I think this administration has been particularly extreme in its approach of really putting a very political stamp on what should ultimately be the best scientific consensus on how to promote, small family sizes or how to make sure women have access to reproductive health services, all the stuff that we know is critical. And so I have been pretty concerned that it's moved far beyond abortion into a much broader range of issues, which I think have no basis in science or facts.
Getting ready to talk to you today, I went back and listened to a podcast that the two of us did for Pulse Check about 2 years ago, almost to the week. President Trump had just been inaugurated. We were talking about how you saw the global health landscape playing out under this administration. Just quick question, yes or no. Are you more worried about what has actually happened than what you thought would happen?
So it's a hard question to answer. So yes or no, I'll say I am – things have turned out better than I feared, but of course not as good as I had hoped. Again, I think the U.S. remains in a very prominent position. I had worried we'd have this massive pulling back of financing and engagement. That has not happened. I think that's good. But it's always a risk, and we have to remain vigilant and make sure that America continues to have a leadership role in global health.
On that podcast 2 years ago, we talked about a piece of professional advice you once gave me. I think about it all the time. When we talked about it 2 years ago, it got a lot of compliments. So I want to resurrect your idea. And essentially, I might be butchering it a bit, but the idea is professionally find the one thing that you're good at. Do it. Nail your core job, and then other opportunities will open up. Is that roughly the maxim?
That is. And certainly what I have seen happen over and over again is if you can figure out what your day job is and do that really well, the world lets you do all sorts of other stuff.
So there was a second piece of advice that I did not mention on that podcast, but you have shared with me privately too, because I remember years ago, I was wrestling with whether to make a professional move, and there had been a big moment in the healthcare landscape. The Affordable Care Act had passed, and there was an opportunity to do something professionally. And you said to me, there are only so many moments that come along in your career where you can really jump in, and it's your chance to make an impact. So I feel like this is a way for me to flip the professional moment on you. We're coming up on a big moment for you. About 5 years ago, you were asked to take on leadership at the Harvard Global Health Institute at the time, and you've been very open about this. You were not necessarily a global health person. Now you're jetting to Geneva on the regular. Is there another moment coming for you, Doctor, or is the Harvard Global Health Institute, is this the last best job you think you'll have?
Boy, it's a great question, Dan. You know, so first of all, I'm extremely happy with the job I have. I feel like it gives me a lot of freedom to sort of think about what are the most important pressing issues and how do I garner the intellectual forces within Harvard to focus on them. And I think there are very few opportunities like that. So I am actively like not looking for a job. I get options come by and I'm very happy where I am. That said, you know, what drives me probably more than anything else is opportunities that push me into new directions, push me into new areas, really force me to learn new skills. And that has certainly been a major benefit of running this institute. And I think any opportunity I think about in the future is going to be driven by, am I going to be able to learn new things? Am I going to be able to be impactful? Am I uniquely situated to be impactful? If I can find another opportunity where I can have bigger impact and continue to learn new things, I'll always look at them. But right now, on a day-to-day basis, I feel like I'm learning a ton. And most days, I can convince myself that I'm doing something useful.
If the Trump administration came calling and asked you to come on board and lead the rethinking of the readmissions policy, is that a job with considerable impact and appeal?
You know, I find so many aspects of what goes on in this administration so morally objectionable that it would be very hard for me to actually take a role. I'm happy to advise. This is our government. Their policies have big impact. So I'm happy to try to play a helpful role. But I don't think I could get over the moral objections I have with this administration to actually go work there.
Well, we'll see if they take your calls after listening to this podcast and as they rethink the readmissions policy. Dr. Jha, thank you so much for joining. I can only imagine what time zone you must mentally be in, having just flown back from Geneva, but appreciate the wisdom as always.
Dan, it's so fun to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Mikayla Rodriguez, our producer in Washington, D.C., and Dennis, who's handling producing from Boston today. Thanks also to Ashish Jha for making time after getting off the plane from Geneva. You can find Pulse Check on all of your favorite podcast apps. You can find me at ddiamond at politico.com. You can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week. We're hoping it's going to be a good sit-down with an influential senator on healthcare.